Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock right now on this day. In 1913, on the 3rd of October, the Federal Income Tax Law would be signed into law in the US by the president at the time, Woodrow Wilson. Interestingly enough, it would be signed in at 1%. Today, the lowest that rate is at 10%. 1918, 5 years later, a gentleman by the name of Boris would be crowned King of Bulgaria, taking over from his father, Ferdinand I. In 1932, Iraq would gain independence and join the League of Nations. I'll give you three guesses who they gained independence from. Someone that we've probably mentioned more often than not. 1941, on this day, Adolf Hitler would decide that, or would declare on radio, that Russia was in trouble and would never rise again. Looking back on it now, I think he would probably take those words back. In 1955, on this day, the Mickey Mouse Club would premiere. 1971, on this day, Jackie Stewart would win his second driver's title. In 1977, on this day, Indira Gandhi would be arrested for corruption in India, but she would later be released the very next day. In 2008, on this day, George Bush would sign a $700 billion bailout for the United States financial system. He'd sign that as a bill. I wonder who they owe. In 2021, on this day, we saw that the Pandora Papers would be released. Obviously, these papers would highlight some very sensitive information around 30 current and former world leaders and their wealth and finances, including one former Prime Minister of the UK, Tony Blair. You tune into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we take a look at the drive by the South African Reserve Bank to switch to digital banking. We've got a conversation with the SARB around the increase in the amount of digital banking solutions that are out there, even though South Africans seemingly still prefer to use cash. Then we've got a conversation with the FSCA. We usually do warning Wednesdays. Today, we're doing warning Thursdays. We're going to be looking at their zero tolerance approach, some of the enforcement matters they've had in place, and some of the actions they've taken lately. And then we've got a conversation with Regent Business School around their upcoming offering for 2025 and everything you need to know around that. Then, because it's Thursday, it's SME Thursdays, we're going to be taking a look at Darling Brew, a brewery in the Western Cape.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We kick things off with market movements throughout the day. Today's been an interesting day of market movements. Again, some markets not moving at all. The likes of China still closed for Golden Week. And I'm joined on the line by Senior Market Analyst at Xnest, Terence Hove, to take a look at some of the market movements throughout the day. Good evening, Terence. Lovely to speak to you as always. Let's start with international markets. We'll come back to local. Let's start with international. Everything in the red, nothing to smile about unless you're living in Japan. The Nikkei seemingly the only index trading in the positive. US markets were in the red as well. I see now Nasdaq slightly clawed back into the green, but it's seemingly a very concerned time in global markets.
Yeah, good evening, Jimmy. Quite an interesting week. I mean, if we think of where the week started off with that announcement of that Chinese stimulus, which actually gave quite a big boost to their equity markets, and where we are today, I think that the sentiment is reminiscent of what's been happening. I mean, in between that stimulus, then we've had the Middle East conflict, escalating quite considerably, and there's expected volatility out of there with more warnings coming from Israel with regards to more strikes. That is also dampening the sentiment. And earlier in the week, we also had the U.S. Fed, Jerome Powell, pushing back on, what markets were already pricing as a definite 50 basis points cut come the November 7th meeting, the FOMC meeting. And we've got the biggest jobs data, the U.S. non-farm payroll coming out tomorrow, Friday. So there's a lot of mixed bag of sentiment going in. So uncertainty is really starting to pick up in the markets at the moment.
So the markets clearly have a lot to be concerned about and a lot to digest and consider. Where does that leave us, Terence? I mean, as you said, some of these things are ongoing developments. Some of the things are announcements that have come out recently. How would we make sense of the announcements? How are we pricing everything? Because I'm looking at commodities pricing, and typically I would think in an environment where there is so much uncertainty and so much risk at play, you'd be seeing a flurry to safe havens. That's not happening. The dollar's not really the safe haven at the moment. It's waiting on those results. At the same time, the gold price is also kind of hovering around a certain level. Where do investors run at this point?
Yeah, I think this is a more of a hold situation. We can't really say plow into any particular instrument or depending on what your long-term strategy is. So this is more of the near-term view rather than the long-term view. I think the long-term outlook still remains favorable. The concern, though, is, you know, with the Middle East conflict, if that escalates beyond what it is at the moment and Iran's retaliation leads to supply chain constraints, and if that happens, then that will affect the oil prices. If the oil prices are affected, then investors would be likely concerned or should be concerned for, you know, a higher, you know, oil prices, which could bring back higher inflation. So that is what the uncertainty, the hold is at the moment. You can't really go into a particular direction. The U.S. has been very good. The non-farm payroll prints throughout the year have been good, but they've been revised downwards as well. So with the big 50 base points cut and generally global central banks are now in a cutting cycle, so we're expecting lower interest rates, which is expected to boost markets. So I think the key data becomes the driver of the decisions. So it's more buying the fact and selling the rumor, really.
Terence, when we look at our own local markets, they've also kind of been on the receiving end of this sentiment downer that we're seeing take its effect in global markets. And I'm looking at just the performance today. Resources down again. Resources have kind of had the toughest time, and we saw sort of towards the end of September, possibly the week before the last trading day of September, we saw a big push in resources. We're seeing almost all of that work become undone.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the work is becoming undone, but I wouldn't say it's the finality of the sentiment or, you know, the pricing at the moment. I mean, the Rand is still fairly strong compared to where we've seen it earlier in the year. We're closing the market at about 17.50, which is, you know, considerably good, you know, that 17 handle. The sell-off we're seeing is, you know, pricing in that sentiment that's going in. So I wouldn't be too concerned at the moment, you know, because overly, you know, if we take the 1 or 2 days or this week, it can't be, you know, the entire snapshot of, you know, the strong rally that we've seen, you know, in terms of our own local markets. The JSE has performed very well, you know, considering even earlier in the year, considering all the factors that, you know, were at play, the higher for longer, that, you know, stayed in a bit longer than it should have. And now we're in this cutting cycle. So I wouldn't be too concerned. It's more of near-term adjustments that we're seeing at the moment.
You make a very valid point there, Terence, around the fact that it is about perspective and keeping an eye on what that perspective looks like. I mean, if I think back to, as you said, the top 40 around February of this year alone was at around the 65,000 points mark. Now we're still closer to the 80,000 points mark. So certainly it is about taking stock of that perspective and remembering that these temporary movements, or some of these movements, might be temporary in nature. Terence, when we look at the performance of the Rand, how is that faring? I mean, 17.50 is kind of back where we're at. We briefly got our hopes up when we saw 17 Rand coming through and looking like we could potentially break 17 Rand. Are we still optimistic that once the dust has settled, we can go back towards 17?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the Rand is a very good gauge of sentiment in terms of emerging markets. I mean, it's a proxy for other emerging market currencies as well. So I think this pricing in that we're seeing, you know, from 17, the market or the Rand did all it could to get to that 17 handle. For it to push lower than that, I think within South Africa, we need it's been a lot of goodwill that we've seen, you know, a lot of positive news, a lot of positive sentiment. But as we go into the next, call it 6 months, you know, a lot of that needs to be consistent and more good news needs to come in. Reading an article earlier, we need growth of about 2%, at least GDP for the next 2-3 years, you know, for us to really stimulate the economy well. So it is, you know, promising where we are at the moment. So I wouldn't be too concerned, because this pricing that we're seeing is really reminiscent of all the geopolitical tension that is at play. That is the big driving factor at the moment, you know, because in the cutting cycle, this is favorable for emerging markets. It tends to be more of a risk on sentiment than it is risk off. So all the other factors are in play, you know, positive play for the South African rand to come back lower. And we need more support, you know, from our government of national unity as we go into the next 6 months for it to break that 17 handle. And of course, what that means is business is being supported and stimulated to see that growth.
Terence, you bring up a very important point here, and we had a conversation around this yesterday as well, to say the growth prospects are certainly there, but there's a lot that still needs to kind of be done in order for us to achieve those prospects, realistically speaking. We've been kind of looking at growth anywhere between 1 and 3%. I want to get your thoughts around that. What are your expectations if we can get some of these factors right? Do you think we could realistically punch above 2%?
Yeah, I think 2% is a good consistent level. Anything above that is a plus that we can take. But to expect, say, 3% and then we get to 2%, then it would seem as if it's an underperformance. But in reality, it's been good performance. So I think anchoring it at that consistent, call it 1.8, 2% range, you know, is wise, if I could call it that, rather than overshooting that expectation at the moment, because there's still quite a lot, as you've said, that still needs to come into play, that still needs to put in place structurally, you know, from the previous administration, the things, you know, that our president had to get right, and seeing that follow through in this new administration. So I think 1.82% is more a favorable range and realistic, and anything above that, definitely we take it.
In that range, Terence, before I let you go, what are you liking most in terms of, if that's kind of the expectation and that's kind of where we think we'll land, what sectors are you liking the most that you think would have potential to not only get us there, but also perform well?
Yeah, I think the two particular sectors would be, firstly, the property sector that has done fairly well, given the higher for longer, you know, backdrop, generally, not just in South Africa, globally, tackling high inflation and a lot of the pressures that property prices went under, but it's done considerably well. So going into this cutting cycle, that could give it a further boost. And that's always a very good indicator, you know, of long-term development for an economy, you know, because generally property is a long-term investment. And I think the retail sector is likely to come back stronger because, you know, more cents and more rands are going to be in the consumer's pocket, and that will stimulate spending within the economy. That would ultimately drive their earnings and the share prices higher. So I think those are the two sectors that I'm keeping an eye on.
Very interesting indeed. We will keep an eye on those sectors and see how they perform. More importantly, we will see how the markets start to react as the tensions hopefully die down. Thanks so much, Terence, for the time and for the insights. As always, Terence Hove, Senior Market Analyst at Xness, on the market movements as well as what potential areas of opportunity might exist in this interesting time.
Unleash your workforce's potential with Regent Business School, proud BBBEE Level 1 provider. Elevate your team's capabilities through crafting a future-ready workforce with top-tier accredited qualifications. Immerse your company in a culture of ongoing learning, paving the way to success. And what sets us apart? Regent's custom business programs are tailored seamlessly to your company's requirements. Visit regent.ac.za. Regent Business School. Be the future.
And in your business news, Reserve Bank Governor, what's his name, has repeatedly said this and that, and policymakers are expecting rates to go up or down. With inflation somewhere between 0 and 100%, interest rate relief may come sooner or later. Who knows, really? The whatchamacallit slid into undefined territory based on the Dohiki being so-so, and the markets were hard to describe. Despite initial doubts, the outcome was a mixed bag. The rand was meh based on the US consumer prices, but sentiment towards the currency could be, you know, whatever.
You can't base a decision on imprecision. Ask your financial advisor about a guaranteed annuity from Momentum Wealth. Personalized certainty.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Earlier today, our central bank governor, Ntate Lesetša Kganyago, came out with an announcement saying that it is all good and well that South Africa is moving forward, but he feels that we're still using a little too much cash, especially given all of the technological advancements that exist in the day and age that we live in. I have the privilege of speaking to the head of National Payment Systems, or rather the head of the National Payment System Department at the South African Reserve Bank, Ntate Tim Masela, around this and trying to make sense of how we move forward from here. Ntate Masela, thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with taking a look at a very interesting statistic that 50% of South African adults still withdraw the cash as it hits their bank account.
Yes, thanks for the opportunity and greetings to you and your listeners. Indeed, I think we did a payment study prior to coming into this conference, where we got some insights of the consumer preferences and which payment instruments they use. And indeed, in terms of transaction volumes, cash is king and captures the bulk of the transaction volume. But in terms of value, cash is lower than card and other electronic means, meaning that the users of cash are buying in small baskets, many transactions, low value. And we took from those insights aspects where we have an action plan in terms of our digitization roadmap.
When we look at that digitization roadmap, I mean, obviously the adoption of digital has some strategic advantages. Would you say that currently the lack of adoption or the slow rate at which South Africans are moving towards digital has something to do with a trust element?
Well, we put in the basket many aspects, including this one, where two specific aspects we believe could be top of mind to consumers, and we need to come up with convincing solutions. One, consumer protection. People believing that if they go into an electronic transaction, maybe on the accepting side, it could be that the transaction could be reversed, but when they get cash, they get cash, it will never go back. And secondly, is financial crime. Some people believing that if they engage in digital payments, they could be scammed. And if they have cash, maybe is that. But there's an element of consumer education and an awareness that we need to embark along the solutions that we put for consumer protection and cyber resilience. And of course, over and above the issue that could relate to fees, to say, if I buy electronically, maybe my money is going to fees, but if I withdraw once, I pay one withdrawal fee, and then I transact multiple times with that cash. So there's aspects that we need to deal with, but on the extreme is the instruments that needs to be available for me to buy anywhere digitally if I choose so. If we take the point of sale devices that we use for car, we could use a mobile phone to exchange value that we believe many people have. we could make a difference so that people have choice. We're not saying they should go off cash, but they should have a choice to use cash when it works for them, and they should have a choice to use other means when it works for them.
Speaking of that choice and the convenience of that choice, I mean, the Saab was instrumental in ensuring that we got the PayShap system off the ground. And that's been such an important thing to bring into when we look at digitization. Because for the longest time, when we've looked at these things, everything's gone through the banking system as it currently stands or as we know it. And consumers have always said, look, but maybe this is going to be expensive. Let's go through innovations like PayShap and things like the Saab's sandbox that exist around wanting to make the solutions more affordable, but still maintaining that element of trust.
True. I think you raised an important point around PayShap. PayShap is supposed to give South Africans a fast, convenient, low-value payment mechanism. And to the issues that I spoke about, protection, crime, and fees, you bring fees then, we should ensure that low-value transactions on PayShap, and we come to the public openly about this, should be free. So that there's no fee for low-value transactions. We can agree on what that threshold is, what low-value means. But those transactions should be free so that you get the same experience as when you use cash. Secondly, we would like PayShap to be available at till points to say, rather than use a card, you can say, I pay PayShap, and you pay that merchant with a PayShap. So we need this person-to-merchant use case to be entrenched. Currently, it's focused on person-to-person. You need person-to-business, person-to-merchant. And if we have those cases, I can choose whether to use a card or to use a PayShap. And sometimes even incentives could be offered for people to prefer what is safer. But we want all the mechanisms to be safe and convenient. That's the bottom line.
Dr. Masala, speaking of safe and convenient mechanisms and having more mechanisms in place, how much of this is part of the Saab's role? I mean, the Saab as the custodian of our national payment system, obviously that's as critical as it can get. But I'm looking at things around innovation. I mean, one of the big things that's kind of prevented innovations like PayShap from coming on board is the need for regulatory compliance and the headache that comes with that. And it might be a headache, but it is necessary. We understand, of course, that it is necessary to have compliance and regulation in place. But is it too much compliance? Is there too much red tape that's stifling innovation and causing monopolies to come up out of nowhere?
Now, to your question, when we talk regulation, everybody says there should be proportionality. We shouldn't have a very a hammer killing an ant type scenario. But indeed, we believe that we can enable that. We have embarked on a payment ecosystem modernization journey that is in some ways going to attempt to address what you're saying. Let me just share the background. Mm. We're saying in payment systems, the middle mile infrastructure that connects the parties should be a utility that is shared. And the providers of the service should compete on products and services on top of the shared infrastructure. So if we share this infrastructure, we will benefit from economies of scale, and the innovators can come on top of that. Then to your question, there's maybe three issues that I'll just talk to. The first one is the identity of who I'm dealing with. How am I sure that when I'm paying this person and they are above board? Mm. Secondly, if there's fraud in the system, we need a mechanism that sits in the middle, this infrastructure in the middle, that helps everybody to take decisions to root out the fraudsters. At the moment, we find a situation where this party says, I'm better on fraud to that one. There shouldn't be competition on fraud. We should collaborate to root out the criminals out, and the middleman infrastructure should do that. Now, to your question, if we get new entrants, which are smaller players, and they find these building blocks, it would make it easier for them to come in. Because if we don't, they have to each build these fraud systems and build that system, and it's costly for them to afford. So this ecosystem modernization is attempting to lay the building blocks on which everybody can leverage, and we have a safe and maybe the one kind of crime-free would be a strong word, system that would actually ensure that everybody benefits in terms of the integrity of the system that we deal with.
One of the things I've always loved about the Reserve Bank is its ability to look at the bigger picture and want to make the systems and ecosystems better. Dr. Masella, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the payments environment and the payments ecosystem. Obviously, from here to move forward and to be able to continue to grow, it does require everybody to come to the party, work together to build this ecosystem. How do we then ensure that the right information goes out? Because if we build the system and the people still don't use the system, then we haven't built a very effective system, right?
Indeed. I think the coordination of this aspect is at the moment in place, but it's facilitated by the National Treasury, where we say consumer awareness and education.
Mm.
People should be informed, especially so that they can even claim their rights when somebody tries to abuse them. But they should know which instruments are better than others and how they can leverage. And that's where we emphasize choice. We say, if you give the people the right information and you point them onto the dangers, then they decide what to do. And at least they have choice to say, understanding the environment, this is the best that I think suits me. And that indeed is underpinned by information that is being provided as part of the consumer education interventions.
Well, these interventions will continue, and we'll continue to do our part wherever we can. I think it's important to emphasize that the South African Reserve Bank, as an institution and as the custodian of our national payment system, is the final point of contact around the trust element. And if anything is endorsed by the Reserve Bank, it means they've gone through all of their red tape. Thank you so much, Dr. Masella. That's Tim Masella, head of the National Payment System Department at the South African Reserve Bank, on the move to digital. We have to do it, we should do it, and we can do it safely.
Unleash your workforce's potential with Regent Business School, proud BBBEE Level 1 provider. Elevate your team's capabilities through crafting a future-ready workforce with top-tier accredited qualifications. Immerse your company in a culture of ongoing learning, paving the way to success. And what sets us apart? Regent's custom business programs are tailored seamlessly to your company's requirements. Visit regent.ac.za. Regent Business School. Be the future.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
I know it's not Wednesday, it is Thursday, but we're going to do Warning Thursdays this week, and we're going to be taking a look at a couple of developments from the FSCA space in the financial space. We know that we recently, today, got confirmation that there was that prison sentence handed down to the former CFO of Steinhoff, but we're going to look at that. We're going to look at a couple of other matters, and helping me look at these matters, as always, is the Divisional Head of Enforcement at the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, Gerard van Deventer. Gerard, lovely to speak to you as always. Let's start with the latest round of enforcement actions. I mean, the BHI matter, or BHI related associated parties, there's some enforcement developments there. Take us through that.
Thank you very much, Jimmy. And as you know, the feeling is mutual. I really appreciate that I can use this platform that you use to inform people and to hopefully prepare them better for making good financial decisions. So yes, we can kick off with the whole BHI story. As you know, and it's old news by now, that we finalized the BHI trust investigation, and the person who was in control, Mr. Warner, went to jail for 25 years. And the interesting part of that sentence was, of course, that 10 years of the 25 years were specifically for contravening a financial sector law, in other words, doing unregistered business. I think that's such an important message for the FSCA, that do not think if you conduct unregistered financial services business that the worst that can happen to you is a monetary penalty. This is the reality, and we are very, very happy about that outcome. But unfortunately, Jimmy, as life goes, that doesn't mean it's the end of our job, because unfortunately, there's some issues surrounding the BHA Trust and that Ponzi scheme collapsing. And that's the big question, is why did regulated FSPs, licensed financial services providers, why did they put their clients' funds in there? And that is an ongoing investigation. We started off with global and local, and the key individuals, the rectors, there was Mr. Haldane and Mr. Forlan. And, of course, what we are looking at there is how did you advise your clients? And the big issue there is the appropriateness of a product. Jimmy, this is an issue that's so important for the FECA when we think about our financial services providers and advisors. Is if you advise a client, you must make sure that there's a proper match between the risk that the client can tolerate and the risk of the product that you put him into. So even if we accept that BHI Trust was a legitimate operation, which it wasn't, the question is still, why would you put retired persons into a high-risk investment? They must have a low-risk appetite for sure. So that's one of the big issues there. It's a contravention of one of our codes, but the big point is we expect of our financial services providers to always take special care on the level of the risk that they place their clients in. And of course, we expect them to be the gatekeepers. So we cannot tolerate our financial services providers putting their clients in. And of course, the issue being into a company that is not registered itself. In other words, doing business with an unregistered entity. And those are the big issues there. Both directors have been debarred for 30 years. And that really shows the seriousness with which the FECA take this type of thing. But as I say, the investigations are not over. There are other FSPs we're looking at. And, of course, this specific investigation is also ongoing. So we may consider further sanctions in the long run.
I think it's so important, as you're saying this, around the debarment for 30 years. While some people might consider that quite extreme or quite excessive, if we look at the victims of these particular cases or the amounts of monies that consumers have lost, 30 years might not be enough. It's clear, though, that the message from the FSCA is that there's a zero-tolerance approach towards these indiscretions. Umkarat, let's look at some of the impersonations. You said that there's a couple of people that are conducting business or unregulated business or not having appropriate products. And I suppose that comes as well in the form of impersonators that proclaim to be associated with a certain financial institution or with a regulated entity when they're really not.
No, absolutely. This impersonations is really the flavor of the year. You would have seen that we just announced, we put out a public warning around Rescura, a regulated entity. But on Telegram, of course, they impersonate it. And then you get the other issue that you and I have spoken about so often, Jimmy, and that is unrealistic returns. I mean, there's an investment of 5,000 Rand and a promised return in a short period of 25,000 Rand. That is just fantastic. We can both retire. And that's a big red flag there. But you are right. These impersonations are really very popular these days and very sophisticated. So the public must be extremely careful, always check with the FECA. We've got a very interesting case, and I'm going to give you a bit of a sneak preview because I'm not too sure that the public warning is out yet, but very interesting case that we are about to publish. And that is a gentleman who decided he's going to tell the public that he actually works for the FEC and he's the inspector master of the FECA, and if the public who lost money in scams, if they pay him a certain amount of money, he can recover it for them. So that's another warning that's about to come out. So that's another form of impersonation, actually impersonating the FECA personnel. That's also still ongoing. And you of course right, these are just scams. So there's no talk even of suitability of the investment or anything like that. But artificial intelligence are helping these people to be very good at impersonations. And that's a great concern. And all I can do is say to your listeners, be very, very careful and do not get involved in investments that you get over social media.
Well, Mkharad, let's look at the practical information that listeners and consumers need to be aware of. This last case that you're going to be publishing, it highlights such an important thing around having the correct information. And if we can just share that correct information with our listeners and with our community at the moment, the FSCA, where it comes to these matters, does not charge the public for these services. Is that correct?
Never. Absolutely. That's entirely correct. We are funded by levies on the industry. We have no reason to charge anybody for anything or the work we do. We do our investigations. We get paid to do it. And we take our enforcement action and sanctions. There's no charge involved in that. So if you are requested for an upfront fee from the FSCA, you must immediately know that it is guaranteed to be a scam. Yeah, that's just one of the things. And also, you're not going to see the FSCA cold calling people to say, I can recover your money for you. Because that's actually the other leg of it, Jimmy, is our primary mandate is not to recover funds. Our primary mandate is to regulate the industry, to take enforcement action. This whole recovery, sometimes if we get the opportunity, we certainly will use it. If we can get the opportunity to recover, whatever that case may be, or through a business rescue or a liquidation or whatever, we will assist and we will support. But we're not really in the business of recovering funds. So a message like this, you can accept it's fraudulent.
It's very simple, folks. Do your homework, do your research, ask the questions. And if it's too good to be true, it unfortunately is. Don't get suckered into these things. Otherwise, you'll find yourselves in these awkward conversations where we have to suddenly see if we can help you recover things, and it's going to be impossible to do that. I think we'll leave it at that. Gerard, thank you as always for the time and for the insights. Gerard van Deventer, Divisional Head of Enforcement at the FSCA, on the latest round of enforcement actions, some warnings and things to be aware of.
When it comes to investing, we have a steady hand when things get shaky. Volatility is inevitable, but for active investment managers like us, it presents opportunities. 91, investing for a world of change. 91 is an authorized FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This feature is brought to you by Regent Business School. Elevate your team's capabilities through corporate training. Visit regent.ac.za. The 2025 academic year is around the corner and Regent Business School is open for business. They have quite an extensive offering that they'd like to tell us about. I'm joined on the line by student advisor at Regent, Asande Nyandeni. Good evening, Asande. Thanks so much for taking the time. Regent has some very interesting programs that you might not find at other sort of institutions. Tell us about the programs that are on offer, especially those that might concern people that have a bit of an entrepreneurial spirit within them.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. So firstly, just to answer your question, at Regent Business School, we have over 25 years of experience in cutting-edge blended learning, and this essentially equips our students with vital skills that they need to transform and redefine possibilities in a constantly evolving world. So what sets us apart is our wide variety of accredited programs. We offer programs from diplomas, higher certificates, degrees, MBAs, postgraduate qualifications, and so on and so forth. We also do offer an empowering experiential learning environment that essentially integrates advanced digital learning tools with our innovative ID labs. So these labs immerse our students in disruptive technology while fostering essential entrepreneurial skills. So at Regent Business School, we deeply believe in bridging the gaps between academic theory and obviously practical application. So our work-directed learning program is a key part of this mission, It offers students a hands-on approach to prepare them for the dynamic challenges of the professional world. Additionally, as part of our unique offering, every student who registers for a formal qualification at Regent will receive a complimentary management development program, which is valued at a whopping 7,000 rand, along with two free short courses.
Asanda, you mentioned something about blended learning when we started the conversation, and I want to get into that because obviously a lot of the individuals out there that might be interested in going and expanding their skills or expanding their offering might not have necessarily the time. Can you take us through just the ability that Regent offers for people to be able to study and work at the same time, but also how customized the programs are?
Absolutely. So we do understand that professionals Archer has busy schedules. This is why we obviously offer flexible training options. So our online skill development courses, they allow employees to learn at their own pace. And this obviously makes it easier and convenient for them to actually balance work and learning.
Asanda, how do people get hold of the Regent Business School? I mean, there's a website, but obviously if someone wants to have a discussion around what programs might line up for them and which ones might be best suited for them, how do people get hold of you guys?
Yeah, so our listeners have three options to explore and engage with us. Firstly, they can visit our learning centers, and this is where a dedicated student advisor like me will be ready to assist you in person, obviously providing you insights and more information into the programs and answering any questions that you may possibly have. We also do have open days. So our open days are hosted every Saturday between the times 9 a.m. to half past 12 p.m. This is obviously a fantastic opportunity for our respective students to come into our campus, experience the Audi Labs firsthand, and obviously get a feel for the dynamic learning environment that Regent Business School has to offer for them.
Asanda, when we think about students, typically people kind of think, oh, someone who's just out of high school or just finished studying or looking to study further. But the reality is there are corporate offerings as well. And I'm thinking about companies that have a need to grow their organizations or upskill their own individual staff within an organization. Does Regent cater for that? And how do companies then take advantage of this?
Yes, absolutely. So Regent Business School offers an extensive suite of workforce solutions that are essentially designed to support organizational growth and success across the various sectors. So these specific solutions include specialized programs in management and leadership development, supply chain management, human resource optimization, and just-in-time learning opportunities. This is obviously ensuring that employees gain relevant, up-to-date skills. Additionally, we also do provide formal higher education programs, short learning courses for organizations with unique needs. We can also create tailor-made packages, which will obviously be designed with specific objectives and industry demands that are catered to the organization.
Asanda, one final recap on those contact details. It's regent.ac.za. Are there other details? Can we find you on socials? What are the social contact details for those listening?
Yes, absolutely. So obviously our website is regents.ac.za. This is where you'll find all of our resources, all of our information, obviously all of our offerings that we currently have on offer right now. We also are on social media. We are on Instagram, Regents Business School. That is our handle. On Facebook as well, we are Regents Business School.
And when do applications close?
Applications will be closing mid-February, but there is a chance that they might get extended for obviously those students that would still be looking for schools to study at. But for now, our registrations will be closing in mid-Feb.
That's all registrations for the 2025 academic year, folks. You don't want to miss this. You want to reach out to Regent. Get in touch with them if you are an individual or if you're a corporate looking to expand the knowledge of your individuals. They're certainly available to assist you with these. Asanda, thanks so much for taking the time and for the insights. That's Asanda Inyandeni, who is a student advisor at Regent Business School, on the offering that they have available for the 2025 academic year. This feature was brought to you by Regent Business School. Advance your team's capabilities through skills development training. Visit regent.ac.za.
Unleash your workforce's potential with Regent Business School, proud BBBEE Level 1 provider. Elevate your team's capabilities through crafting a future-ready workforce with top-tier accredited qualifications. Immerse your company in a culture of ongoing learning, paving the way to success. And what sets us apart? Regent's custom business programs are tailored seamlessly to your company's requirements. Visit regent.ac.za. Regent Business School. Be the future.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's Thursday, it's SME of the Week time, and we're taking a look at a local brewery. The brewery is based out of a small town in Darling in the Western Cape in South Africa. The company is called Darling Brewery, aptly named, and I'm joined on the line by the company's managing director, Tiavi Rus, to just get a sense of what the business does. Good evening, Tiavi. Thanks so much for taking the time. Darling is an interesting place to have a brewery. What's the history there?
Hi, Jimmy, and thank you very much for talking to me. The original founders, Kevin and Philippa Wood, did a little bit of an Africa tour, and I got introduced to the craft brewing industry during the tour, and they then decided that it's quite a grand idea to build a craft brewery. Originally in Darling, as a garage operation, if I can put it that way, where they brewed in plastic barrels their first brews, and very quickly realized that the potential of a craft beer is much bigger than what they could produce. Kevin and Philippa then started talking to other brewers that were already in possession of proper processing equipment, and they expanded the business then to contract manufacture with them. And that worked quite well for them until the point where their demand exceeded the contract manufacturer's own product portfolio and started getting trouble from the contract manufacturers to get product within time. And they then decided to invest into a bigger brewery or a professional craft brewery in town still. And in 2015, they've built the current brewery from where we operate and manufacture, in my opinion, the best beers in Africa. Most of the beer competitions will concur with what I'm stating now. Yeah.
That was going to be my next question, Tiavi, is how does one become Africa's most awarded brewery? What goes into what you make, and what is it that you make?
Well, I'll be dishonest to anybody if I say that good experience with Alt SAB and working with them contributed significantly in training and exposure. So I come from an engineering background where I've worked with SAB for the first 10 and a half years of my career and been exposed quite well into the entire industry during that period of time. Associated with that was really good standards and processes that we've got taught in SAB. I moved then into basically equipment supply to the beverage industry, where I've then dealt with other international brewers like Heineken and Guinness. And during that period of time, I had the opportunity of seeing what was best in operations like SAB and in Heineken and Guinness best operations and learn from the international players. In 2019, Mario, who was the biggest investor in the brewery here in Darling, requested me to come and have a look and see if we can help improve the operations, which I accepted. And the initial focus of myself was to really concentrate on getting consistent, good quality beer out of our operation, because my analysis at that stage indicated that the craft industry suffers from a perception that sometimes they do great beers and other times they do very poor quality beers. So consistency was really my focus and getting the quality to the levels where I believe it should be.
Tiavi, speaking of quality and really good beers, you at Darling Brewery now make a gluten-free beer? Take me through that. How does that even happen?
We started off with a gluten-free lager, and it was driven by, can I say, the knowledge of people that cannot enjoy the wonderful golden fluids, which we call beer, due to gluten, can I say, intolerances. And we decided that we would venture into that to develop a gluten-free product. There's a lot of different ways that you can do it. There's different, can I say, fermentable sugars. The yeast process where you can use enzymes that take out your gluten component in the product. And we experimented extensively to find where you get a good quality product that are truly qualified as a gluten-free product. And we opted then for a production process that really allows us to get the best intrinsic values of the beer while you have also the absolute guarantee that it will be gluten-free for the customer. Yeah.
Divi, how do people get hold of you? Someone out there listening to the show who wants to try the gluten-free beer, wants to try anything else that Darling Brew has on offer. How do people place orders, reach out to you? Do they have to drive all the way to Darling?
No, fortunately not. Darling Brew is nationally available through our online platform and through Takealot. So probably the easiest or most convenient way is through Takealot or our online platform. Further to that, we have a warehouse in Johannesburg, and we supply to the major retailers, and most of them adopted the gluten-free range as part of their listings. And then, obviously, the best way to get it is at Darling Brew itself here in Darling, where you can enjoy the hospitality of our taste room team. You can actually taste the gluten-free and other products if you want to venture into the other products, and you can have a look at our wonderful facility from which we operate here.
Divi, what next for the brewery? I mean, obviously being award-winning is one thing. Taking on other breweries in these competitions is something else. But what next do you guys have in mind to grow the brewery and take it to that next level?
We study the market quite extensively to understand exactly what's happening in South African and international trends. And we are positioned. I have no other way of describing it. We are David against Goliath in the industry. So our volumes are very small compared to the bigger players in the industry. Our route to market is quite challenging. And that's really where the crux lie in driving a business is, number one, we need to get to a point where our route to market is optimized, where we have an attractive offering, where the bigger retailers will start driving the sales together with yourself, and then start developing strategic partnerships with your on-con consumption partners in the industry. They're really the people that have the opportunity of exposing new customers into your products and ensure that you have a far-reaching, can I say, experience base on which you extend your reach in the market. Focus on the route to market. We're also looking at the challenges that we find in the industry. We find currently that your glass packaging is the very, very expensive, packaging methodology, and we're looking at optimizing or driving better cost alternatives there. One of the options which you find in the industry as a growing market is canning, for instance. Canning also holds the benefit that it's actually quite environmentally friendly, which is one of the main pillars on which the Darling Brew portfolio and brand is founded or standing on. Also very proud to say that we're the only carbon neutral brewery in Africa, so it's quite an achievement that we try and focus on being a sustainable citizen in what we do here.
Divi, how does one become carbon neutral in the brewery space? I imagine there's a lot of components that go into the beer making process or just the brewery process in general. How do you manage to then achieve carbon neutrality but still produce really good quality products at the end of it?
There's a lot of different aspects to consider. It starts with your supply chain into your business and optimizing that, working with responsible partners in your supply chain. Then optimizing production processes, where you look at your energy consumptions, how to drive down energy, how to optimize conversion, because a big portion of your beer is water, and that is normally quite an important indicator in the efficiency of your operations and the, can I say, reduction of waste. We looked into our packaging practices to ensure that the packaging material is recyclable. And then on your waste. Also, we not only try to reduce the waste from the brewery, but we, for instance, developed a beer grain crisp, which is produced from one of the byproducts of your brewing process. And it's actually a very, very nice product at the end of the day. It's very responsible from the way that we treat it. and it's quite healthy. It's got a higher fiber content than a normal crisp and 50% less fat. So it's quite a healthy alternative to your traditional crisp that you get in the market.
Carbon neutral, gluten free, but most importantly, 100% local. Give Darling Brew a shout for the next time you want to try something different. I think we'll leave it at that. TRV, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. That's TRV Roos, who is the managing director at Darling Brew. You can find them online at darlingbrew.co.za. They're available on Takealot. They're at Darling Brew on Facebook, Instagram, and X. Next time you're looking to try something new, give them a shout. We've come to the end of the show. If you've missed any of the conversations, tune in or catch up on the conversations rather online. They're on the MoneyWeb website. They're on the MoneyWeb app. We also have our show on the SABC app. It's coming up to 7 o'clock. Greg Kos is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Brian Mofokeng and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.